We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined at long last by Quinn Kesnick, who has gotten through football season, and he, like myself, we are turning our attention to this spring and what it means for college lacrosse. Unfortunately, this time of year, as has been the case for the last 8 months, what we would normally be doing has been very disruptive. We're recording on Wednesday afternoon, and at this time in a normal year, Quinn, I would be lining up meetings for LaxCon.
I would be reading through my lacrosse magazine Face-Off yearbook in preparation for a game on February 1st. Last year, I covered a game on February 1st down at Duke for the ACC Network. So very different right now. A lot of uncertainty in the air. It's great to see teams practicing and posting things on social media. Many have started small group practices. Others are waiting for later in January. And then others in the Ivy League, of course, are waiting for a green flag.
So as opposed to a traditional season preview, which we've done in many different formats over the years, I've set us up with 10 questions that I think help set the table, and we will reconvene with some regularity as we march toward the beginning of games. But the first of the 10 questions is actually a two-parter, so I guess to some extent this is 11 questions. But they are similar, and they really touch on what you just laid out, which is the confidence around a season. So how confident are you that something that qualifies as a lacrosse season is going to occur? And how confident are you that the NCAA will crown a Division I men's lacrosse champion this year?
I am confident that we will have a season, and it may be partial in that some leagues may struggle. I am confident that the ACC and the Big Ten will play a lacrosse season, perhaps a league only, perhaps more, with a few non-conference games. I believe they'll have league tournaments, and I believe there'll be some sort of NCAA tournament. Now, will it be a 16-team bracket, 8-4? Will it be Memorial Day? That's what it's looking like. If it were I would push it down the road into June to give the weather a chance to get people outside where the virus is less impactful, but that's just me. But yes, I'm confident that we will see a lacrosse season focused on the ACC, Big Ten. I think the Big East is doing good things as well. I worry about some of the smaller conferences.
And why do you worry about some of the smaller conferences?
Well, just because they're testing. You know, if you're only testing twice a week, there's a chance. Look, teams test six times a week. That's fantastic. That's an internal test to keep their program safe, to keep a massive breakout on their campus or in their lacrosse program. The fact that everyone tests on Saturday morning and plays lacrosse, that's almost like a sobriety test. I can drink all week, but if when I got in an accident, I was sober. So, you know, I think it's critical for these leagues, and I'm very much against league only scheduling based on, well, we test six times a week and they only test two. Well, on Saturday mornings, everyone who's stepping on that field is negative, and that's all you really should care about. You know, if that team wants to run around all week long, that's their business. Their program will likely blow up before the end of the year. But don't hold it against those athletes if they're negative on Saturday to compete. It's like making weight for wrestling. They're guys who make weight correctly. But the day of the match, I'm stepping on that scale, and we're both weighing 145 pounds and competing.
So do you have the equivalent confidence that a champion will be crowned as you do that a season will occur?
I do, yes. Okay. I believe there will be enough teams to make an NCAA tournament.
Let's turn the focus from what we don't know what's going to happen in the future to what we do know that happened in the past that is kind of setting the table for the present. Which do you think was a big... Okay, so we made the claim in a story on the InsideLacrosse.com earlier this week that McAneer put together that aggregated all of the headlines, or many of the headlines dating back to last March, that this was the biggest offseason in the history of college lacrosse. And we isolated that in terms of the headline dump to men's Division I. So if that is indeed the case, which do you think was a bigger storyline, player movement or coach movement?
Player movement, clearly, because of returning fifth-year guys, because of a list of, 40 transfers, because of a freshman who come come in and roster sizes that bloat to 55 or 60 member teams. Yes, there were a couple coaching changes that are notable, but this is a situation unlike any we've ever dealt with. I mean, it's actually cumbersome to study for this podcast. I mean, I rarely study for these podcasts. This is a podcast I had to study for. I mean, there was so much that's gone on since March 11th last year. That you can easily lose track of where a player is, who's gone, who's not. It's crazy.
The player that we ranked number one in our grad transfer portal rankings was Michael Sowers. We also declared him the player of the year in the 2020 season, and he made his decision to transfer to Duke. They added the number one incoming recruit in the class of 2020, Brennan O'Neill, who I would argue is the most heralded recruit in college lacrosse, and at the very least the last 10 years, I would say, at the least dating back to Lyle Thompson. And they join a team that had lost twice, but was very good and didn't suffer some of the graduation losses that other programs, specifically in the Ivy League, did. And in addition to adding Sowers, added a goalie in Mike Adler, a faceoff guy in Dan Connell, and got some players back from injury, including Joe Robertson, who was likely to miss the season last year, as well as some of their fifth years coming back, like JT Giles Harris. So my question for you is, is Duke the prohibitive favorite?
Absolutely. I think it's hard. Mentioning the guys you mentioned could be four starters. Add in Phil Robertson as well.
Yep.
You know, the Sowers-Dyson-Williams combo. You had Owen Caputo, who last year was emerging. Nakai Montgomery, Cam Bedour, Garrett Ledman. Then veterans like Joey Manown and Lowry. I mean, there's a lot of talent there. My question marks would be more on the defensive side for Duke, but in my eyes, they're a clear number one. I mean, you could throw out their top five or six players and they'd still be a top six team. I mean, that's how stacked they are.
Who's another player who transferred that you are particularly interested in seeing what he looks like in a new uniform?
Well, I Kyle Gallagher moving to Notre Dame is extremely significant. And Kyle Thornton as well for Notre Dame. I think Notre Dame was the number two ranked team, you know, in terms of player acquisitions. You know, Duke would be one, Notre Dame would be two. I thought the ACC just picked up boatloads of good players, as many left Ivy League schools. So those would be some guys. You know, I'm interested to see how this Bowden Suzluck defender, who I saw from Lafayette, looks at Johns Hopkins. I was pretty impressed with him in the one game I saw Lafayette play
against North Carolina.
He looked the part, and obviously Hopkins picks up a goalie in Josh Kirsten. So they're plus two. The Blue Jays are plus two in terms of starters. You know, Jackson Marl, though, would be the answer to that question.
Oh,
without a doubt.
I thought you were setting Jackson me up to Marl, come in over the top with a good novel response, because he's my pick as well.
No, he's the pick. 220 points. His relationship with Ian Walker is going to be spectacular. Okay, I, in my text messages with Coach Tierney already, there's just a symbiotic relationship. Righty lefty, a passer shooter. You know, that cross the goal stuff. That down look and transition. There's a lot to like between those two. And Denver's going to have a very nice offense. But Morrow fits like a glove in that program that hasn't had a quarterback behind the goal. He's often overlooked, but you look at his production, it's been so consistent. He can do a little bit of everything, and he's a good kid. So that's a terrific pickup for the Pioneers.
I wrote about Jackson's decision to transfer to Denver for the January issue of Inside Lacrosse magazine and got an opportunity to interview him. And the most exciting and interesting part of that conversation was how I was able to test this theory that I've really been thinking about since I got wind of the fact that he was looking closely at Denver, which struck me as a surprise, I think, because his dad played at Hopkins. A lot of people assumed that that was the likeliest spot, he's from Baltimore, for him to land. But once I started thinking about the idea of him in Matt Brown's offense, it started to make more sense. There's one thing I wanted to add before I dive into that detail, and that's that I appreciated one of the things he said, and this will probably come up later in the conversation as well, but Denver has an enormous roster, as pretty much every team that didn't lose their seniors does. It's 67 guys. And that is a football roster. But one of the things that he appreciated when he got an opportunity to talk to the returning seniors over Zoom over the summer when he was making decisions as to where he was going to transfer was the sense of seriousness with which he expected them to handle the virus this fall and spring. And what he meant was, or this is my inference into what he was saying is, if, you know, I don't have to play another year of college across, I can start my professional career off the field and play PLL. And if I'm going to play college lacrosse and sacrifice what's necessary in order to do that, certainly there are benefits. I'm obviously he chose to do that. So clearly there are benefits, but if I'm going to make the sacrifices that are necessary, I want to make sure that I'm doing it in an environment where my teammates aren't not there with me, right? They're not 100% of the way with me. And we're going to, this is going to be worse than it would otherwise be. The payoff is not going to be as great as it should be because, you know, some of these guys just aren't taking it seriously enough. They're not willing to sacrifice and wear masks and be separated and get tested and show up on time and do all the other things that are necessary in order to get the best out of this. So when you combine the fact that he was on the field more this fall than he had been in any fall prior because of the Ivy League's 10 practice limit, you know, even if it was in small groups, I think he really enjoyed just the opportunity to play lacrosse in kind of that pure way that any lacrosse player would have enjoyed it given all the circumstances. But to the point about the way he fits in, I had this experience that I really cherish watching Canada versus the U.S. at the 2014 World Championships, where they got shellacked in the first game. And then over the course of the tournament, they moved Jeremy Noble from running midfield to playing that X attack role. And at this point, we'd become pretty familiar with Denver's offense. They had made it to the Final Four, I believe, three of the prior 4 years. That 2012 team that lost to Loyola in the quarterfinals, I probably saw 10 of their games. So felt like I really knew who Denver was offensively, felt like I knew who Jeremy was offensively. So I was really surprised to be surprised by how important and how effective he was in that role. And the reason is because even though Jeremy Noble is a special player, he's neither an ex-attackman nor an overwhelming athlete. But the reason he was effective in that role is because that offense, and I think it's evolved, but I still think the principles are in place, which is Matt Brown, as an offense coordinator, more than anything else, values the way that the ball is positioned compared to how players are balanced on the field. And the guy at X is really important in terms of taking the ball from the heavy half of the field and distributing it to the right person at the right time on the light side of the field. So basically, if he's the sixth guy, there are three guys on one side and two guys on the other. More often than not, they're going to want to attack from that two-man side. And the ball is most effectively going to be delivered to the right player at the right moment when he's coming off of a cut. And that knowledge is so valuable. And I can't think of a player better suited to fill that role that I've watched play college across in the last 5 years than Jackson Wall, because the accuracy and the timing of his passes, as well as his kind of like steady focus throughout, it's tailor-made. I think it's going to be a really, really good fit.
Yeah. And just while we're here, according to Coach Tierney, practice so far is going great. He's broken up the team into what he said were three groups of 30, you know, for smaller type practices to keep spacing. Obviously they're not allowed to use their locker room in mass. But so far, so good with them. And Yale enrolls on February 1st, and they have no direction for lacrosse right now. You know, it's tough, and it's got to be tough for the Andy Shays and the Jerry Burns of the world to see, heartbreaking, really, to see their peers practicing, and they're still TBD, to be determined. So, you know, our thoughts are with the Ivy teams, and I really hope that they let those kids play, because I think lacrosse is important for their development. I think it's a part of their educational process. And as I told you, I think mental health is important, and it would do wonders for these kids to get them back on the field.
So let's dive a little bit deeper into that, because you mentioned Jerry Byrne. He tweeted earlier this week about the uncertainty combined with the 18 months of memories that he's formed as the head coach of the Crimson. And I think when you overlay the fact that they're, you know, were notably, I believe, three teams in the top five at the end of the season, and that didn't include a Penn team that had beaten Duke and was off to a really good start, and they were going to get, or likely they were going to get Sam Hanley, who I think many regard as their best player, back, and they'd been quarterfinalists the year prior. Between, you know, Princeton, Cornell, and Yale, and then you had Penn, and even the intrigue around seeing the progress of Dartmouth and Harvard, and then Brown having their season end with a win over Virginia, all seven teams had tremendous optimism when the season was shut down, I think. And so they are among a group of roughly 15-ish, maybe, you know, more than that, but 15 to 20 teams that weren't able to bring back seniors. So they were going to have right-sized rosters if everything went normally. They certainly aren't able to bring in transfers the way that most other programs are as well. They were already going to be at a competitive disadvantage. And when you add the uncertainty of, are we going to play, you create an incentive for your players who are going to be allowed to do it to withdraw in order to preserve eligibility to then come back and play at a later time. So some of the, and then not only that, but for the teams that are going to give it a shot or potentially going to consider giving it a shot, in terms of who they have on campus from an academic standpoint, some of these schools only have, say, for example, sophomores and seniors, or just freshmen and juniors, just freshmen and seniors, whatever. So there's like a composition issue as well. I think it's worth it because of the role that they played in last season, because of the role they play in the landscape, and because of that uncertainty. You've already mentioned your opinion on the value of athletics when it comes to the academic and full education of an individual, but can you just go on a little bit more about what the potential for a season that doesn't include the Ivy League teams actually means?
Well, as you said, they were on the opportunity, the cusp of something really special last year. Cornell was rolling. Yale was going to be good. Penn was going to be good when they got healthy. Harvard was on the rise. Oh, don't forget about Princeton. They were 5-0.
Yep. So they were one of those teams that was in the top five.
Yeah, opportunity lost. What worries me most if they don't play this year is future. What do recruits view the Ivy League as? Because while I think this year's teams are going to be good, I don't know if there's a national championship contender amongst the Ivy League teams. But certainly between Yale, Cornell, and Penn for now, I would say that they're quality playoff teams, certainly potential quarterfinalists. But, there's so many life lessons that can be learned by fighting this. You know, I saw it in college football. I saw a Texas A&M team that came together for the first time in a decade. Us against the virus, the discipline, the sacrifice, the teamwork, the bonds that were built go well beyond. It's part of the educational process, part of this experience. And so by turning your back on team sports in the spring, I really think you're denying your student athletes the opportunity to fight through some adversity, to learn discipline, to learn teamwork, sacrifice. There's so many lessons that can be learned. So I just encourage educators to take a shot and let these kids play.
For me, I think about it in the context of the Ivy League schools, because of their financial position, they stand alone in terms of what their motivations and incentives are. And they try to be fair in their practices and policies. So they look at it not on an individualized basis, like this is the choice we're making for our athletes or whatever else. And what it really comes down to is that I think the Ivy League is kind of the only, those schools are the only places where, you know, they're not making these choices for financial reasons. If they were, they'd probably play. Whether you look at it from the one end of the spectrum where college football needs to play for its TV and sponsorship revenue, or college basketball needs to play for its March Madness revenue, or you look at it at the other end of the spectrum where tuition-dependent colleges need to play in order to make sure that their students are enrolling, the Ivy League doesn't really suffer from either or benefit from either of those financial incentives. And so they don't really suffer from the pressure of not playing in the same way that the others do. And so when you look at it, it's like, all right, well, what does that say about their decision-making process? But I agree with you in the sense that where is the intersection of the right choice, the best choice, and the choice that is the most democratically arrived at? And it's pretty clear that these kids, these men and women, these student athletes, these players want to play. And how much weight does that desire hold in the equation is something that I would like to know better about.
How many sports can the Ivy League claim to be nationally relevant in? I would put lacrosse at the top of that list. Cornell wrestling's had some national champions. Princeton wrestling's on the way up. Yale hockey's won a national championship. But team sports, I mean, lacrosse is what they got. And if they don't invest in that, it's going to come back to haunt them 3-5 years down. You're going to have an exodus of coaches. You're going to have recruits who shy away and go to Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, Virginia, and other great academic institutions instead.
You mentioned Hopkins, so let's move there. One of the biggest stories of the year in 2020 was the transition from Dave Petromala, a 20-year head coach who had won 2 national championships as a head coach in addition to his all-time great resume as a player. He is replaced by Peter Milliman. You have already spoken about it on this podcast. So now, as you look forward and think about what a new regime under these circumstances and conditions might look like with the Blue Jays playing on Homewood Field in the Big Ten, what are reasonable expectations for Johns Hopkins this year?
At the end of the year, to be a top 4 team in the Big Ten, I think would be a positive, because right now I don't have them in that mix behind Penn State and Maryland, Ohio State, and an improving and very veteran Rutgers team. So to get in the top 4 in the league, I think would be a step forward. This is a massive challenge. No fall, gigantic roster. They're back on campus apparently in training, which is good. I love Coach Milliman's staff. I think he put together just a beautiful blend of expertise, and Jameson Kesterer and John Grant Jr. and even his Cohen and his volunteer. I think it's a good mix. So he's making the right moves there, but there's certainly a lack of talent at the midfield and defensive midfield position that puts them behind programs like Penn State, Maryland, and Ohio State right now, in my eyes.
Yeah, the question I asked, you answered properly. A different way to ask a similar question is, how good do you think they're going to be? And I think they're going to be better. I think that they are going to be better than the 4th best team in the Big Ten. I think that they're going to be better than 15th to 20th, which is where they're being ranked. And I think the biggest reason, it has far less to do with the coaching staff. It has far more to do with a healthy Joey Epstein. And I think that they'll benefit from the, I guess, confluence of, we lost a season, we had all this disruption, let's just focus on the task at hand and move forward. So I don't know. I mean, it's not as rational as when you look at the rosters on paper. I can make a really compelling argument that Denver is going to be super, super good. I don't have that ability with this Blue Jay team, particularly in light of losing Owen Murphy, who I believe was either their second or third leading scorer and entered the transfer portal and has yet to find a destination. But I remember watching Hopkins Loyola last year, and even though the Greyhounds pulled it out, thinking that this is a dangerous Blue Jay team in a couple of ways, and Epstein's absence is one of the limiting factors. Now, granted, I watched the Mount St. Mary game as well, and I thought Mount St. Mary deserved to win. So it cuts both ways, but just wanted it to be on the record that I think that they're going to be better than the 15th best team in the country and better than the 4th best team in the country.
Fair. I just have huge question marks about their defense, both close, the pole position. They pick up Jared Fernandez, but the shorties. I mean, when you bring 6 out there, the other team's going to attack your 2 worst, and those are your shorties. And they don't have upper-level shorties right now.
Along the same lines as the question about which player you're most excited to see play in a new uniform, which team that we have not yet discussed do you have your eye on heading into the season?
There's a handful by league I could give you. I really think Richmond's going to be pretty good this year. I liked what I saw from them. I covered their game at Duke last year. Felt they're a young team, getting better, a lot of talented players. Obviously, Coach Chamati does a fantastic job. I think they could be the team to watch in the SoCon. UMass brings a lot back. And remember, Delaware had some momentum. I'm kind of leaning the CAA to UMass and Delaware. Denver, as we said, I think Georgetown's going to be good again. Some of the smaller, Marist's win last year over Army, I think can be a building block for them in the MAC. And then the NEC's pretty open. Robert Morris is now an independent, but you got St. Joe's, Hobart, who lost a lot, and Bryant, who's probably going to be better than they were last year. So those are some teams. Patriot League, I think, is maybe the most fascinating league from top to bottom. Wide open. I mean, completely wide open, because, Loyola's not what they were. you know, Army, Bucknell, Lehigh, Navy, very, very tightly grouped in my eyes.
It's interesting. When you say Loyola is not what they were, is there a particular reason that you say that, or just generally speaking, they, you know?
Well, they're not a national championship Loyola team or a Final Four Loyola team. They're still a good Loyola team.
Sure.
But that team's not.
That doesn't mean right that does not mean that they're head and shoulders above bid.
That doesn't mean they can't win their league.
Right.
But this is not a Loyola team that you're talking about as a potential national champion. And we've done that in the last decade, what, two or three times.
Right.
They've been a contender for it all.
One of the things that I think is interesting about Loyola is, so ultimately, in order for them, the storyline for their season last year was going to be replacing Pat Spencer. And the question was, is there a guy on the roster who can be 70 to 80%? And, you know, it was clear that Aiden Olmstead was the one that they looked to. But I think ultimately the answer was going to be they're going to have to play different. And that's not a surprise. That's not uncommon. That's what happens. I do wonder how an additional year of time affects that. One of the aspects of playing differently is that it's not just about your 6-on-6 settled offense. It's about how you approach the game and who your contributors are all over the field. And I'm interested in how Bailey Savio affects what they are able to do, because one of the other big stories of the offseason was the change to the faceoff rules that basically eliminated the knee down moto grip and now mandates that players take faceoffs in a standing neutral grip. The idea behind, or the objective to the extent that it's stated behind this rule change, was to prevent tie-ups and get the ball out faster, with the knock-on effect of reducing some of the disproportionate dominance that individuals might have, as well as reducing the role that specially designed face-off heads have in the success of particular players. I am the type who says, until we see how this actually comes to fruition, making assumptions about how it's going to affect both teams, who the best face-off guys are, how a season long of facing off unfolds, I just think it's a little premature. And this is coming from somebody who has watched probably 30 days of recruiting tournaments that utilized standing neutral grip face-offs. I would say I didn't really notice that big of a difference. And one of the reasons is because unless you're diligently keeping stats on both win percentage and who's picking up the ground balls, and you're doing it across multiple games when people have opportunity to react and you like counter each other, well, you're not really creating a situation that's going to be equivalent to what you see in the season. All that being said, one of the biggest assumptions is that this favors athletic faceoff specialists. Now, athletic can mean really quick, right? Your first and second steps are super fast, so that helps in terms of getting to the ball. It can be really speedy, meaning that, you know, you're top end speed from yards 10 to 20 is determining whether you're winning a ground ball. It could potentially mean that you're really strong in terms of your ability to box out a player. What the assumption is that it favors technical proficiency less. Now, again, I am not accepting that assumption at face value, but I am interested, Quint, in what you think or what you expect the face-off rule changes to be or to mean for this season.
I think it's a positive. I think you'll see it. You know, obviously the ball is going to get out a lot quicker, less prolonged circular pile driving into the ground, more athletic face-off guys who are lighter on their feet, let's say. And I'm basically in agreements with everything you're saying. The biggest deal right now, though, for face-offs is COVID. Think about contact tracing. If you have a face-off guy on your team that tests positive, does that mean all the other face-off specialists, because they were around him so much in practice, would be medically considered to be out with contact tracing? So I've reached out to some coaches and asked them to get some clearance on that. There's still some fuzzy areas in terms of, well, you're allowed 15 minutes if you're masked. So all their drilling is going to have to be done with masks. Less than 15-minute increments. There, it's really important that you keep your goalies and face-off players apart from one another. But that's counterproductive to those guys
facing off against each other. So, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that to manage. Okay. That's really important this year because we may see a game where teams without three players, fine. But if you're without your top three Fogos, you got issues. Okay. You may not win the game. If you're without your top two goalies, you got issues. So coaches have to be really delicate with the way they're training these athletes, the amount of contact they allow between athlete, whether the mask's on. The medical advisors will step in with the directive as to, yeah, I'm sorry, that was contact tracing. Your backup Fogo can't play. He's got to sit out for 7 days or till he turns a negative test. Or the other thing we got to consider is hearing that the referees' mechanics are going to change on a faceoff because of COVID-19. So this is still an area that I think is still to be determined, still trying to figure it out, still trying to massage this. But this is certainly on the minds of all these college coaches as practice starts.
Were you in favor of the rule changes?
Yeah, I like this rule. I like this rule. You know, I feel bad for the successful guys who, you know, the Greg Ranlians and the T.D. Erlins and the Trevor Baptistes, whose success is really just magnified a lot of face-off detractors.
Right.
Those guys are just – they're awesome. They're ball hogs and machines, and their dominance I think led to a lot of scrutiny. I love the face-off. I don't love the Fogo. I've written about that before. I don't love the specialist. I don't like to see a guy secure the ball and run off the field. I'd love to see these guys stay and play a shift, and the best guys can, like Trevor and Greg and TD. Those guys could easily play a shift, whether it's offense or defense. They're supreme athletes. And I could see the position heading in that direction when a guy like Kyle Harrison could take a face off and then exploit a matchup to where, you know, you have a little more athletic face off guys.
Sure, sure. You brought up the issue of contact tracing, and I am going to pull off an excellent segue. We saw in the College Football Playoff Championship that Ohio State was down a bunch of their kickers because of their practicing together as a unit. And you mentioned earlier in this podcast that you saw Texas come together in the face of adversity. What are some of the lessons that you learned from your college football coverage this season that are going to inform your expectations and the way you're thinking about this college lacrosse season?
Well, I think student athletes have to look at it like a day-to-day thing and a week-to-week thing. You know, you want to stay in the hunt. So in order to practice this week, I got to test negative on Monday. And so that's going to impact my behavior on Saturday and Sunday. And that's a positive. You've got to stay disciplined, okay, through the course of the week and stay smart in terms of your social distancing, in terms of keeping your bubble small, you're keeping your crowd of friends to people you know who are negative testers as well. And then don't let the uncertainty of a canceled game or a game maybe you're hearing rumors about a team's health. There's going to be cancellations. There are going to be bye weeks. There are going to be schedule changes. And you got to roll with the punches. I think the most important thing is to take joy in the fact that you're back on the field. Okay, if we all go back to last spring, how miserable everyone was, you're back on the field practicing amongst your friends. And that in itself should be celebrated. Every time you get a negative test, you got to pump the fist. That's what I had 18 negative tests this year. I'm pumping the fist. I get to BWI, I get on a plane. I'm like, yes, test again on Thursday or Friday, negative. I can work. I can actually go to a game and cover a game. And so the post-game celebration's not there. We're not going out to a restaurant. We're not going out to a bar. We're not celebrating. It's very muted. Okay, your celebrations this year will be very muted. So celebrate the little things. You know, celebrate being able to practice on a Monday. Celebrate, you know, getting on multiple buses and going to a game. You know, just celebrate the fact that you're able to play the sport and you got to suck it up and stay disciplined. Okay, getting COVID's there's a little bit of a lottery quality to it. You know, there's I could easily get it at the grocery store. And so you got to get a little lucky, but you also got to play the odds and be smart.
It's really well said, particularly the part about celebrating the small things, because talking to your colleague Paul Carcaterra last week, one of the things he pointed out or took away from this football season was that by the end of it, he literally said, he's like, these guys were exhausted. He basically said, following the protocol on top of going to school and playing football, or in this case, lacrosse, is exhausting. Just adding the layer of protocol to the normal workload that an 18 to 22 year old has to incur really took it out of him. And
Completely agree. These teams were toast by the end of the year. And I'll add to that, Terry. Teams in contention for a league championship, a great bowl game, or a title game, a CFP, college football playoff appearance, they were tight with their protocols. The teams who were 2-6, the teams who were 1-5, the teams whose season went sideways, they kind of strayed. And so you saw the breaking of discipline among those teams. You didn't see the breaking of discipline amongst guys who wanted to play in the NFL, but you saw it with some other players. And so I would encourage everybody to set goals that aren't related to your record. And when you start this thing, agree to finish it. No matter how ugly it gets along the way, you got to finish this off. Okay, you got to make it through the season. You got to try to play every game you can play. And I agree with Paul. The players were emotionally just fried by the end of the year.
So we are at our 10th question, and it's about the end of the year, and it's dessert, right? If this was a 9-course meal to get to this point, and there were some hearty dishes in there, this is that souffle that should be pretty easy going down. Close your eyes. Imagine it's Memorial Day Monday and you're at Rentschler Field. What do you hear? What does it sound like? What does it smell like? Just give us something positive, something exciting to wet the beak with as we end this podcast.
5,000 fans, all closely tied to their teams, socially distanced, witnessing an all ACC Final Four. No, but seriously. I mean, do we want to be playing on Memorial Day? That's my biggest question right now. We saw what the virus did to the Big Ten football teams in November and December during the cold weather. It forces everybody inside. When I covered games at UCF and Florida in Gainesville, they had all their team meetings outside because they could. The weather was nice. They had far better success against the virus. The weather is our friend, and I don't think there's any benefit to starting this thing early. But if the NCAA is insistent upon Memorial Day, then that we have to back time the season, and that's just the way it's going to be. But I see a strong year for the ACC. I thought they benefited most from all this the Ivy talent, influx of Ivy talent to the ACC. I'm hoping to be at the Memorial Day in person. Who knows? We could be broadcasting it from my office. You know, there's a strong likelihood that we'll be broadcasting a lot of games this year. Offsite. Don't get to go to practices. Don't get to go to team walkthroughs. Don't get to interact with the great coaches and the players. That takes a lot of fun out of it. But that's a weekend that I hope we can be there in person and showing the country how great the sport is and how these athletes have persevered just like the rest and done a great job.
Well, Quint, that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse podcast. As always, appreciate your time. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. He's at Q Kesnick, right, on Twitter?
Somewhere, yeah. Just and go on to Instagram. Niche and find out the guy he's picking on.
And I don't know if we'll be back next week or the week after, but the season is quickly approaching. And as we get more clarity on what it looks like, we will be back with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts coming your way.
Can I have one word, Terry? Last word, you know, insidelacrosse.com, their Instagram page has been terrific as these teams ramp up. Teams are back at practice, some of them. Others are waiting in the wings. And just to get a general sense and an excitement, I encourage fans to check those out. They're good images from these programs as they're getting started. Kind of gets you in the mood, gives you a positive view of what could be the spring. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.